All right. I thought I would start by asking whether you had any questions on the antitrust stuff that we did last week. Speak now or forever hold your peace.
Yeah, on the artificial monopoly.
Yes.
So it's like predatory pricing has to occur. I mean, with the Standard Oil example, you said you found no evidence.
Yes, or the person who wrote the article found no evidence.
Okay. So I guess for an artificial monopoly.
Well, you could also imagine buying out everybody.
Yeah.
That's closer to what happened. That is, Rockefeller did buy other people's refineries. And the only trouble with that in the long term is that then becomes profitable to build refineries in order to sell them to Rockefeller. Mm-hmm. He ends up with more capacity than he can use. But you could imagine doing that, and certainly in a short-term sense, you know, just the merger case, if you only have two firms, you merge them, and for a while you can hold prices up, but at the risk of pulling in somebody else eventually when you do that. The U.S. Steel, I think, when it was originally formed, Morgan basically bought out Carnegie and a bunch of other people and put together a steel firm which had, I don't know, a very large fraction of the total market, maybe 80 or 90%, and I don't know if it's down to 10% now, but it basically declined over time as more firms came in. Doesn't mean he didn't make money doing it, though, right? I mean, you'd have to know more. Questions on the consumer and producer surplus side stuff I did last time? Does that all make sense to you? Because it's a fairly important economic idea. All right, let's start then on legal systems, very different. And again, before I start talking much, do you have questions on stuff in that chapter? This, the first of the two chapters assigned for this week, since I don't know if we'll get to the second one today or not. Anybody? Basically doing is that many different societies in different times and places have had legal systems, at least if you define legal system fairly broadly, some way of enforcing rights, settling disputes, and so forth. To first approximation, all societies face the same set of problems in how to make a legal system work, but they've solved them in a lot of different ways. And I think studying different legal systems is useful partly as a test of the economic approach, because if it's right, it ought to apply in Athens and Iceland and Cheyenne Indians and everybody else, and not just in modern Anglo-American systems. Partly because you can get ideas. Other smart people have thought about how to enforce the law, and they may have come up with ideas. We haven't come up with some of them. Might be good ideas. And finally, because you can take them as data. You can say, all right, they did such and such, what happened? And at least get a little bit of very crude evidence of, if we did such and such, what might happen, what might be the problems. And I think there are examples of all of that in the chapter and things I'm going to discuss. And let me start out with Iceland, which I suppose is my favorite. That's the first one of these that I actually did, an article written a long, long time ago. And did you have questions about how that society worked? If you want some casual reading, I can recommend Icelandic sagas. They're available. Egilsaga is one of the best and is not all that long, so I'd recommend that. And Njalsaga is probably the most famous, and there are a bunch of other fairly famous ones. So the basic history is that starting about 870, refugees from the unification of Norway sail to Iceland and set up a society there, loosely based on Norwegian institutions. And they, being unhappy with the establishment of the Norwegian monarchy, they do not set up a king. And it's sometimes referred to as a democracy, although it's a somewhat odd way of describing it, given that it doesn't fit our pattern. I suppose it's closer to a democracy than Athens, maybe, but neither of them is very much like what we're used to thinking of as a democracy. And the system has a legislature, and it has a court system. Seats in the legislature, however, are private property. They are not elected. I think the only elective position is law speaker, which is the one permanent position. Not permanent, the one sort of official. The closest thing to a government official is the law speaker, although a part-time official. And if I remember correctly, each election, one quarter of people from one quarter of Iceland who come to the annual assembly get to vote on who the law speaker is going to be. And in terms of the history, the first point at which you can see a real problem arising for that society, as for all the Scandinavian societies, is in the Christian pagan conflict. That the Scandinavian countries were going Christian with various conflicts and fights among people involved in it. And Norway had gone Christian. And Norway always had close ties with Iceland, since that's where the Icelanders had largely not entirely come from. And the Norwegian king was supporting the Christian Icelanders in the attempt to make Iceland Christian. And he was doing things such as seizing Icelandic ships in Norwegian ports and saying, you can't leave until you convert to Christianity, stuff like that. And there was some violence, some killing between Christians and pagans in Iceland. And eventually the two sides come to the Althing, the annual assembly, more or less ready to fight. And in fact, they declare themselves out of law with each other, which I take it means that they were seceding from each other, that they were saying, all right, we may be on one island, but now there's one polity which is pagan Icelanders, one polity which is Christian Icelanders, and who knows what will happen. But cooler heads prevail, and they decide that's a bad idea. And the two sides agree to an arbitrator decision. And the arbitrator is the law speaker, who happens to be a pagan. And the traditional story is that he covers himself with a cloak and lies there for 3 days thinking about what to do, and eventually comes up with the solution, which is that Christianity will be the official religion of Iceland, but pagan, private but not public pagan worship is to be permitted. And I don't know how long that lasted, but that was at least the original compromise. And presumably, though one doesn't, I don't know what the reasons are. One possible reason is the Christians were, even though they were a minority, were more willing to fight for their religion than the pagans for theirs. And the other is the obvious problem of continuing friction with Norway, which could be avoided by going Christian. In any case, that's what they decided on. And I think if you look at the descriptions, it looks as though the whole thing killed fewer than a dozen people. So in that sense, if you think about this odd set of institutions as a way of settling problems, given how much violence there had been elsewhere in Scandinavia, that looks as though it did it pretty smoothly. There are other problems later, a couple of times, which I discuss, and eventually in 1263 and 1264, all four quarters vote to essentially turn the country over to the King of Norway. So the system runs for about a third of a millennium, about 330 years, but there are some breakdowns in the last century or so, which lead to dissatisfaction. And how does it work? The central figure is really the Gothi. And as I comment in the book, that's mistranslated as chieftain a lot of the time, but that suggests a tribal system, and it's not a tribal system. You've got kinship relationships, but nothing you would think of as a tribe. And the chieftain is ultimately somebody who owns a property right called a Gothord. And initially, the term literally means something close to priest. I think Gothi is cognate with God. And I think the usual account is that the original Gothar were important figures among the settlers who built a temple in their little bit of Iceland, and their neighbors came and worshipped in that temple, and that made them the central figure. But once the system was established, it was a transferable property, right? And the property right of being a Gothi gave you two different things. It let you plug into the legal system, or it let people plug into the legal system through you. And I've analogized it loosely to a state in the U.S. And the question, if you want to be able to sue him, you've got to be the thingman of a Gothi, he's got to be the thingman of a Gothi, and figuring out which Gothi each of you has is going to affect what court you sue in. That if there are two Gothar who are from the same little territorial unit in Iceland, then you can go to the local court, and as they get farther apart, you go higher up the system into less local courts. And the other thing that being a Gothi gives you is a seat in the legislature. I think actually three seats. I think you have one vote and two advisors, if I remember correctly. so that the Logretta, the legislature, is made up basically of the Gavar plus one Pleissenbos Christian. I think the two bishops each have a seat as well, as I remember. And the relation between the Gothi and the Thingmen is essentially a contractual relationship. That is to say, it is not, I've sometimes referred to the system as franchise feudalism, in the sense that it's not a territorial system like a modern territorial sovereigns, like states, for example, or countries, but rather something more like your relationship to your insurance company, in the sense that if you're going to drive a car, you're going to have an insurance company, but you get to choose whatever company you want that's willing to have you as a customer. And in this case, similarly for the Gothi and the Thingmen. And you can change from one to another. One of my favorite stories, a noticeable amount of sort of the lore of the popular lore of American law is about trickery and, you know, clever ways people work around the law and so forth. And my favorite Icelandic story along this line involves a lawsuit in which one of the parties is himself a Gothi, and he thinks he's going to lose. So he quietly transfers his Gothord to one of his allies, and himself becomes the Thingman of another Gothi, also an ally, presumably, in a different quarter of Iceland. There are four quarters. The plaintiff then sues him. And part of the procedure in suing somebody normally is to publicly ask him who his Gothi is, so you know what court to sue him in. But they know this guy is a Gothi himself, so they don't have to bother with that. So they sue him, and he promptly countersues them for abusing the law by suing him in the wrong court. And that sort of is an interesting example. There's a sense in which a decentralized system like this really requires a more rigid legal system than our system, not less, because there isn't anybody at the top. There's no equivalent of the president to pardon people, as it were. And on the other hand, given the nature of the system, there is always the out that if the other person is abusing the system too badly, you say, all right, I'll kill you. Now you sue me. And assuming you've got the ability to kill him successfully, that can be fairly effective. And there certainly are threats of violence going through the system, and ultimately the enforcement involves private violence against people who are outlawed. There were 39 Gathar initially, and then in the course of the procedure that went Christian, for some reason they established one more. A little complicated. The thing about the system that first intrigued me, though, is the fact that it's a pure private enforcement system. The reason I ended up writing my article on this was ultimately the Landis Posner article, on which I discuss in the next chapter, on why you couldn't have efficient systems for private enforcement. Since my first book, written long before that, had sketched out what a society with private property rights and without government in a modern society might look like, and that included mechanisms for enforcing law, and so I was interested in the fact that here Landis and Posner and Becker and Stigler, who were all sort of important, interesting, intelligent people, were in effect arguing about stuff related to that. So I tried to figure out how the Icelandic system worked and wrote it up and published it in the Journal of Legal Studies. And it's a pure tort system in the sense that the things we would think of as crimes, they treat as torts, that if you kill somebody, it's relatives to you. And it is a purer tort system than ours because the final enforcement is also private, because there is no executive arm of government to enforce the law. And that then raises a number of different potential issues. And one of them is the poor victim problem, which I think of as analogous in our system to what if you have a tort system but you can't afford a lawyer. And one of them is the problem of the judgment-proof defendant. Why bother suing somebody if you can't pay the damages? And one is the problem of what I think of as the stability problem. What if somebody who's got lots of tough friends just says, well, you've got a virtue against me, tough luck, come try to kill me, I'll kill you if you try. So what keeps the system, as it were, from breaking down into anarchy in the pejorative sense of the term, a system where there are no effective rules? And I think they have found solutions to all of those problems, interesting solutions. And the first one, the poor victim problem, the solution was to make a tort claim marketable. There are a couple of limited contexts in which tort claims are marketable in our legal system. You can make a deal with the lawyer that you won't pay him and he'll collect part of your damages. And a insurance company, you can have what's called subrogation, in which the insurance company ends up collecting your claim because they've paid you for fixing your car, which is what the claim is about. But we don't have any blanket mechanism by which a not yet settled suit. Of course, the third example is that the plaintiff can sell the case to the defendant. That's what we call an out-of-court settlement, is basically selling the case to the defendant. But that's about it. Whereas in theirs, you just sell it to more or less the person you want, and that seems in some ways like a fairly attractive system for a number of reasons, which I discuss in the chapter and may get back to. The second problem is the judge approved defendant. And the first point to realize is that the fact that someone is judge-approved is not entirely a fact of reality. It's to some extent a choice. That, you know, if nowadays, if you're expecting a really big tort damage against you, what you do is to buy a really expensive house in Florida, because the state of Florida does not allow bankruptcy cases to file against your residence. And similarly, you can think of a lot of contexts in which somebody has a choice, both in the sense that before doing things that might get you into legal trouble, you do or don't make sure you've got the money to pay the fine if something happens, and after you get into trouble, you do or don't do everything you can to scrape up the money, persuade your friends to lend it to you, and so forth. So partly the answer is that if you have a system where if you don't pay the damages, something really bad happens to you, more people will be able to pay damages. And am I right in thinking that in the normal... What happens under our legal system if you are sued and you have no assets? Is there any penalty? Yes. There isn't. That's what I thought. Yeah. So that's one partial solution. Yeah, right. And the other one that they have was something that amounted to temporary slavery, where basically you worked the fine off. And I've considered ways that could be done in our system, and I've got some reservations about it because of the problems I discussed earlier about the inefficiency of efficient punishments. It raises possibilities of convicting people who haven't done anything wrong in order to enslave them, but one could imagine some system of that sort. And then, yeah?
I have a quick question about the Godard.
Yeah.
So you said it's sort of like an insurance relationship?
In the sense that it's a voluntary contract, isn't it?
But can a Godard reject you?
As far as I know, he can.
So what if every Godard rejects you?
I guess you'd have a hard time suing anybody.
Okay.
But it's not very likely to happen.
So the way that you make a Godard willing to work for you, so to speak, or represent you, but your patron...
Yeah.
I don't know how you would articulate it.
I suppose you could give them gifts. You could try to make it clear you'll be very helpful. There isn't any sort of formal payment. On the other hand, there is what's called the thing tax, which is that each year when the all thing meets, all of the Godar are expected to go there, each with a bunch of his people, nothing like all of his people. The thingmen who don't go are expected to chip into the travel expenses of the ones who do go. And, of course, the individual Goldie wants to make a good show. So he wants, you know, his people to look nice and, you know.
So they create a sort of free, almost free, reputational thing that poor people can use to...
So, yeah. And presumably, if... My guess is that if you win a case and he refuses to pay, one of the people you will go to get help in enforcing it is probably going to be your Goldie. Wouldn't have to be. It might be, you know, your neighbor or your father or, you know, somebody else. But it's sort of, you've clearly got a system of sort of small coalitions which are partly defined by the Gathord and partly by kinship and, you know, who's blood brother to whom and stuff like that.
It sounds like a mix between sort of an advocate, an entire jurisdiction by itself.
Jurisdiction is closer,
insurance
yeah.
Insurance company. Sounds like
it's not. It's not actually insuring you.
It's not, but like, you know, you...
Imagine our system if you were free to choose what state you'll be a citizen in without living there. In a sense, it's closer to that in that respect, although the state can refuse you, which is the goal that can refuse you, and not sure if a state could. So then the final question is the... In here, well, not the final, but a question is what do you do if somebody tries to, in effect, defy the system? And is it stable? And part of the answer is that because defending an outlaw is tortious, you're going to have a problem if the other side is fighting you, that any time you hurt somebody, all of his relatives are then going to want to sue you too. So there's going to be some tendency for coalitions to expand. Another point which I don't discuss in the chapter, which I think is probably true, is that there is some incentive, if someone is throwing his weight around, for other people to more or less volunteer to fight against in order to make their own reputations. You know, I helped bring down so-and-so. And I think you can see that happening pretty clearly. So, as I think I run through it, you certainly have cases in the sagas where people to some extent are trying to do that. I'm not sure there's any case, at least until the final breakdown in the Sturlung period, at least that I can think of, where someone really succeeds in completely defying the law. Of course, you can always leave Iceland as other possibility. That's a perfectly legitimate option. Other problems, I mentioned the question of gaming the system in various ways. It's, by the way, illegal to sell legal advice. Being an expert in the law is very valuable, and you undoubtedly are getting paid in non-pecuniary fashion, but to literally be given something in exchange for helping with a law code is not allowed, with a law case is not allowed. So the Njal saga, for example, Njal is not a great warrior. Several of his sons are great warriors. Now, Njal is an expert in the law. So expert that no case was held to have been finally settled unless he had had some hand in it. Because you might have gotten it wrong, basically. So how well does it work? And I think there's some tendency for casual readers of the sagas to assume it's a very violent society for much the same reason that people who read about the American West think of it as a violent society. But in both cases, there's a lot of selection at work because peaceful things are sort of boring. And the impression one gets is first that compared to other societies, the violence is quite small scale. That it's not, again, until the Sturlung period, it's not battles with a bunch of people killed. It's more fights with a few people on each side and someone is killed and someone is hurt kind of scale. And looks as though most of the feuds don't last very long. That's to say that the typical feud, something happens, a feud starts, the two parties agree on arbitration, or they go to the court and there's a verdict and it's over, and then the ones that make the good sagas are the ones where that doesn't really finish it, and where, you know, 10 years later, somebody still got a chip on his shoulder, and so he finds some excuse to do something to the other person. There is one sort of famous case in Njal saga, where you have two men who are close friends, Njal and Gunnar, and whose wives hate each other. And Gunnar's wife, who is not the most attractive person, although she's very good looking, gets one of the men associated with her household to kill one of the men in Njal's household. And so Gunnar settles the matter by paying Njal the appropriate amount of silver for Wergeld for killing the person. However, Bergtora, Njal's wife, doesn't regard that as a satisfactory outcome. So she gets one of the men in her household to kill the man in Hallgarthr's household, who had done the first killing, at which point Njal hands the purse of silver back to Gunnar. And it goes on. I think about four people are killed before the whole thing is over with the same passage. So that same purse of silver. I think they increased the amount of silver at one point because someone more important person has been killed. But going on. If we run out of things to talk about, I'll tell you the ending of that story, which involves Gunnar and Hallgarthr, and one of the great lines in sagas. Anyway, does it have any interesting... Final history is... After about 250 years, you get a period of breakdown in which it's hard to know exactly what's happening, but part of what's happening is that pretty clearly the political power is becoming less evenly distributed, that you get coalitions that control a bunch of good in an area, which means you've got less opportunity for competition. And I discuss a number of other things going on that might explain it. I'm not sure anybody really knows confidence, but the system finally breaks down. And one of the interesting numbers I came across in the course of reading up about this, actually after I wrote this article, I think it's afterwards, was the contrast between the shift of Iceland to Christianity from paganism and the shift from Catholicism to Lutheranism. because at the point when they go Lutheran, Iceland is under the rule of one of the Scandinavian kings. Iceland at various points is ruled by Norway, by Denmark, maybe even by Sweden, I'm not sure. And it's under one of those, and the king decides to convert. They all seem to convert to Lutheranism, and there's a bunch of killing and violence in Iceland before it happens, and the total number of people who are killed seems to be about 40 or 50 people. So in that sense, it looks as though the royal system is less able to handle conflict than the older decentralized system. But again, I'm prejudiced, and these are very small samples. It's not like we've got 1,000 cases to compare. What are the lessons for us? I think marketable torts are quite an interesting idea. They, I think, solve some fairly obvious problems of poor people who can't sue. And they also... See, marketable torts have one real advantage to a contingency fee, and that is you can hold an auction. That if a lawyer says, I'll try your case for you on a contingency fee, you don't know how good a job he's going to do. But if you just say, well, here's this case, what am I bid for it? All you have to do is to sell it to whatever law firm offers you the largest amount, which is only the one that's going to do the best job of prosecuting it. You will presumably have to agree to testify as part of the deal, and you can therefore, without having expert knowledge of the lawyers, solve that problem. And I have also suggested that it provides a potential solution to the class action problem. The basic class action problem in our system is how do you make it in the interest of the lawyer to act in the interest of the class instead of selling out for a large payment to himself. And my solution is you make the lawyer actually be the plaintiff by letting people, in effect, sell all their small claims in bundles to other people they deal with, to your insurance company or your employer or somebody else, and then those people rebundle it so that all of the asbestos claims for 30 million people will be sold to you for some sum, and you can then sue on behalf of those 30 million people. And since they've been paid already by whatever they sold their claim for, it's in your interest just to maximize the amount you collect. Make sense?
Well, that actually like it more for class actions than for normal claims. I think that's actually a really cool idea, but the one thing I literally just don't know about would be you would basically have, wouldn't you have a sort of bidding war, not just between firms, plaintiff's firms or whatever, plaintiff being firms, thing, and just the defendants?
You could, that's fine. That'll save you the trouble of going to court. After all, if the defendant is willing to pay for the claims more than any lawyer is willing to pay in order to be allowed to sue and collect, that sounds as though you've just gotten the plaintiff to pay and then cut out the middleman. I hadn't thought about that. I mean, that is indeed a perfectly possible
idea. That's a great idea. Class action.
A perfectly possible idea. Anyway, so it seems to me that it's an interesting system, and this is why I like to claim that our legal system is a mere 1,000 years behind the cutting edge of legal technology, which is a line of. All right, any questions on Iceland before we go on a little bit farther south to England? All right, so England, 18th century, that was another article of mine. And there, on paper, that's a modern standard, modern system, tort law, criminal law. It's our legal system just a few hundred years earlier, except that they don't have police. Saying they don't have public prosecutors is a slight exaggeration, because they have public prosecutors for claims that are literally against the crown. That is, if they rob the treasury or something. But for ordinary criminal cases, they don't have public prosecutors. Instead, any Englishman can prosecute any crime, which is roughly the Athenian system, going back a bit. And then the first puzzle is why bother, since unlike a tort case, you're not getting damages. On paper, at least, this is a system where all serious crimes are capital. And it's hard to make any money out of that because they don't have organ transplants yet. Yeah.
Just a quick question about that. I don't know much about England in that time, but I have a sort of general cultural sense that there were a lot of crimes against the crown, like killing the king's deer in the king's forest or something. Would that be a crime against the crown, right?
I think it would be. But it isn't limited to the king's forest.
Yeah,
they,
right.
In fact, have hunting laws. There's some of the stuff I came across when I was reading for this article, which is a little bit later, involved what I think was essentially extortion, legal extortion, where you have a wealthy man who hunts on his own property. However, the animals he's hunting are animals that officially are property of the crown, and therefore, legally speaking, he's a poacher. And so somebody sues him. Prosecutes a criminal prosecution, expecting to be paid off to drop the charges.
I guess my basic question was: is any is any breach of is any crime against the public going to be
I don't know. That is, my guess is that you would get a crime against the public enforced in the way I just described, that somebody would find it in his interest to prosecute it, not for deterrence, but in the hope of an out-of-court settlement.
But you couldn't have, like, a random person sue because...
It would be suing.
You couldn't have a random person prosecute, say, robbing the Treasury, right?
I don't know if you could. I don't think you would have to.
Right, yeah.
Because the Crown would do it. But I don't know, at least the stuff I've read, I don't know if there was any actual distinction between crimes with, because it wasn't that only the victim could sue, or could prosecute. The victim was the most likely person to prosecute, but it didn't have to be the victim. So I discussed, if you're curious, I discussed the benefit of clergy stuff a bit there, but that's not really very important, except being historically interesting. And then the question is, why do you prosecute? And that's sort of like the problem in tort law of how do you prosecute people who are judgment proof. And in this case, everybody's judgment proof because it's criminal law, not tort law, so they don't owe you any damages when you succeed. And one answer is that you prosecute in order to be paid not to prosecute. And as I mentioned in the book, for misdemeanors, this was the approved of outcome, basically, to try to bring the parties together. But for felonies, it was illegal. In fact, that was what's the modern term? Something a felony? Somebody is guilty of compounding a felony. Compounding a felony, I think, in the 18th century meant agreeing to drop charges for a payment. It was illegal. But I think it's pretty clear that it happens. The University of Chicago Law School Library has some things called the Ryder Papers. I don't know if we have them or not, but Ryder was an 18th century judge, and these are sort of a bunch of his notes. And he describes, I mean, at least one case, maybe more than one, in which it's pretty clear that the victim or the purported victim, who is, I think, the shoplifting case, and he's going to the mother of the girl who he claimed shoplifted and basically trying to get paid off to drop the charges. And so I think that's one of the things that's actually happening. I think there are some other cases that suggest that as well. And the second reason, maybe more interesting, I'm not sure, is deterrence as a private good. That obviously exists now. If you think about, you know, the department store with, you know, we prosecute shoplifter signs, and you can see that it's a natural incentive in the case where you're enough of a repeat player to establish a reputation. If you expect to have someone steal from you, you know, a couple of times a year, the first time you do, and you know, and you can figure out who it is, you try to get him hanged, and then the next guy doesn't. That would be the theory. But to me, the more interesting and ingenious system were the associations with prosecution of felons, because that's a way in which people who aren't repeat players can do it, by pre-committing. And if you look at how those associations work, at first glance, you think they're insurance companies. You think what you're doing is paying a certain amount per year to cover the expense of a prosecution if you get robbed or something. But at least my interpretation is what they really are is pre-commitment. That's really a way that if you're somebody who's only going to be a victim of a crime once every 10 years, once the crime occurs, it's not in your interest to prosecute unless you can make the guy pay you off, because it's going to be a lot of time and trouble for you, and what do you get out of it? Nothing. But before the crime occurs, you would like to tie your hands. Before the crime occurs, you would like to do something such that you will prosecute, and that will then deter people from committing crimes. And I've argued, in fact, thinking of the Icelandic case, that what we think of as vengefulness can be viewed as a rational commitment strategy. That you want to make it clear that you're the kind of guy who resents being injured, and therefore will go to possibly unreasonable lengths to get back at someone who injures you, so people don't injure you. And it's obviously risky, because if they do injure you, then are stuck having to fight them, and maybe get killed in the process. But I think if you think of sort of human societies, especially, I mean, even now, because after all, there are all sorts of contexts in the modern world where people can injure you in ways that aren't illegal. And if you think about, the political marketplace, where, you know, people make promises, I won't run against you if you do this and that, I won't support the candidate against you, stuff like that. None of those are enforceable contracts. And yet you have mechanisms for enforcing them, and one of those mechanisms, I think, is, you know, I bear grudges. And so But the 18th century English one is a formal way of doing it. You set up these associations, you pay your annual dues, you publish the list of the members of the association in the newspaper, and now the burglars stay away from the members of the association because they know that if they rob that person, they will get prosecuted. They might get any. And then another part of what's interesting is the whole pattern of punishment. And that got me partly into the history of galley slavery, which I thought was sort of a fun subject because people think they know about it and they're wrong. There's a sort of standard historical myth of Roman galley slaves, but it turns out there aren't any Roman galley slaves in that sense. There are Roman slave sailors because Rome is a slave society and you could have a ship where everybody from the captain down was a slave, you know, a merchant ship or something. But the idea that you become a slave because you've been convicted of something, you then row a galley in warfare, does not seem to exist in classical antiquity. There is one Athenian battle where the Athenians are short of rowers. And so they promise a bunch of slaves that if you will row for us in the battle and we win, we'll free you. And they do. And that's the one case I know of where you're actually having warships being rowed by slaves in classical antiquity. And then the argument that I offer is that where galleys work, it's really quite an attractive form of penal slavery from the standpoint of the government that's doing it, because it's easy to monitor and make sure people are working hard, it's hard for them to escape, and you get an engine for your warship, essentially, out of it, without having to pay rowers, which you would otherwise have to do. And in the British case, I gather the problem was that galleys don't work as well in high waves, and Britain is in the Atlantic, and so therefore mostly didn't use galleys. They didn't use them very much. They might have used them in rivers and things, whereas the Mediterranean powers did. So England, instead, they shift to transportation. Yeah?
Just a really quick digression.
Yeah.
From what I know, specifically the Athenians, they didn't really hold slaves in very low regard. Like they were just sort of like people who were owned by other people but could do the same work and get the same pay for it, in fact higher pay.
I think it may depend on the slaves. The Athens, a major source of income for the Athenian government was silver mines.
Yeah.
And they had slaves mining that silver. I think they were not, I gather, treated very well. But there certainly would have been slaves. But this is true even if you think about American Southern slavery. There's at least one case of a slave who was a steamship captain. That you basically, one of the options, this is what most slaves were doing, but if you have a slave who has the ability to earn a good income, a blacksmith, a carpenter, one arrangement that would happen is he gets to live in the nearby city and you get half his income. And that was more profitable than keeping him on your estate where you didn't have enough work to keep him busy, essentially.
I guess I meant it more of a social role. Like, I don't think they even dressed very differently.
I don't know.
From what I learned, they didn't dress very differently. They interacted. You know, they thought of themselves as members of the citizenry. Not citizens, but they were sort of members of that polis. Like, I don't know.
They're third class citizens, second class being the medics. Medics are resident aliens, essentially. But anyway, No, but it's interesting trying to make sense of these societies and to understand them as organizations of human beings.
I just feel like if anywhere in the ancient world it would have worked, it would have actually been Athens. Mm-hmm. Like if anybody could have gotten slaves to fight and even without promising freedom, I feel like they could have done it.
Yep. Well, sort of my theory on slavery is that all or almost all real world slave systems are less terrible than slave systems are. That is to say that we tend to view the ugliest features of that as the ones that stand out, and that slavery exists in lots of societies, and it's varied a lot in the sort of way that you're discussing. But the transportation was initially to North America. And for some reason, sometime around 1776, some of the colonies got sort of uppity and weren't taking transportation convicts. And in the short term, the solution was slave labor doing river improvements on the Thames, with the slaves being kept in hulks and floating moored ships. And that apparently turned out to run at a loss, and is some evidence that slave labor or penal slavery, where your slaves are people who, if they get away, are going to banish into the society. They don't have black skins or anything, and they are likely to be, you know, fairly strong adult men of violent tendencies, being they're the ones who've gotten convicted of stuff. The costs of guarding them and the work seem to have been higher than what you get out of them, at least judging by that experiment. Then there's the pardoning case, which I discuss. And there are a bunch of ways you could think of it. One way is it's price discrimination. That is to say, people who can be deterred by a low punishment, you scare them, you keep them in jail for 3 months waiting for trial, and then you send them home again. And somebody who can't be deterred by that, you hang him or transport him. And another possibility is that it's a reflection of the fact that killing people imposes costs on other people. There are external costs to execution. And so if enough people are willing to sort of go down on their knees to beg the judge to be merciful, or the king formally to be merciful, he'll be merciful. But then the last one, which I have more evidence on than I did when I wrote that chapter, is the idea of a market in favors. How many of you know who James Boswell was? He's an English, actually Scottish, 18th century writer who was famous mostly for a biography he did of Samuel Johnson. That's right. Probably the most famous English biography. Boswell kept a diary, sort of a journal, during a good deal of his life. And some point early in the 20th century, it turned up, having been sort of, you know, sitting somewhere for all that time, and got published. And it's quite interesting as sort of a first-hand view of 18th century Scottish and English life. And Boswell was a lawyer. And one of the things in his diary is an incident of his trying to get a pardon for somebody. And this interested me because it, to some extent, at least fitted into the pattern that I was looking at. And the case is as follows. Boswell's very first case as a criminal defense attorney involves a man who's accused of possession of stolen sheep, which is a capital offense in Scotland at the time. And I think it's a man who is, I'm not sure he's a butcher, he has legitimate reasons to have sheep, and his claim is, well, I didn't know those ones were stolen. And Boswell manages to get him off. And a week or two, or a little while after Boswell gets him off, one of the judges in some other case refers to this case as an obvious miscarriage of justice, where a smooth-talking lawyer got off an obviously guilty defendant. I should say Boswell's father was also a judge, and I don't know if there were any frictions between these people or not, but in any case, many years later, the same guy is again accused of essentially the same crime, and Boswell does his best to get him off and fails. And Boswell then more or less moves heaven and earth trying to get a pardon for him. And what's interesting is how he does it. Because he doesn't do it by offering any evidence. I mean, Boswell may believe the guy's innocent. It's not entirely clear. He wants to believe he's innocent. But what Boswell basically does is to try to call in favors. That Boswell knows lots of English aristocrats, mostly because earlier in his life he was trying to get a commission in a very elite English military unit which was stationed in London, because Boswell wanted to basically be a wealthy young man about town, and that was the way to do it. And he was unsuccessful in that because his father wouldn't back him, because his father wanted him to be a useful Scottish lawyer and not a dilettante in London. But in the process, Boswell sort of cultivated friends. And Boswell was an able writer. He knew a lot of important people. So he goes to all his friends and says, you know, basically, can you write the king asking him to let this guy off? And he eventually fails. And as far as one can tell, the reason he fails is that the judge in question, the same judge who made this comment earlier, basically also writes to the king saying more or less, if you pardon this guy, I'm going to resign, because it's just outrageous that Boswell should be able to get an obviously guilty person. So the guy ends up being hanged. But it was interesting because it was the market in favor, and you could actually see it by a guy who was in that market. He is describing how he was trying unsuccessfully in that case to pull it off. And I discuss in the book why it seems to me that that makes a certain amount of sense in terms of the institutions of the time, that it's a way in which you can increase the power of the state. It's the power of powerful people to get people to do things for them by doing favors for them, in effect. What's interesting about it? I think the immediately interesting point is the idea of making deterrence into a private good. I wondered, for example, if one way of dealing with online hacking might be to create the equivalent of the prosecution associations. Maybe they exist, I don't know, but have a firm which says, we have expert computer people. If someone breaks into your computer, we'll go to a good deal of trouble to find them, sue them, get them prosecuted. And at the entrance to your computer, as we're in cyberspace, you can hang a big sign saying, "We are customers of eSure Death, Incorporated," more or less, something of that sort. But in any case, it struck me as an interesting solution to the problem of how you give people an incentive to enforce the law. And as I'm going to be arguing at the end of this, one of the central thread that runs through all of these legal systems is the incentive to enforce. And it's a double-edged problem, as it were, because you aren't going to get the law enforced unless somebody gets some benefit out of enforcing it. But on the other hand, if the benefit of enforcing it is too high, then you get people going after you who haven't done anything, going after deep pockets, essentially, and the equivalent of that. Really healthy people who have lots of organs you can transplant or something in order to profit by doing so. So that's sort of a potential problem. Yeah?
Well, so you contrasted England to France in the 18th
right.
century. So I guess another, I would posit that another problem with the system with sort of private papers,
yep.
I mean, beyond it, you know, seeming
you're talking about the pardoning system.
The pardoning
yes.
paper, right. So beyond, you know, the fact that it's unjust and
yes.
transparent and so forth, It doesn't really, my sense is that it doesn't really allow you to plan ahead. Like, it doesn't make the laws predictable. So you can't, whereas if you have...
Well, but in our sense, it's unpredictable in the sense you don't know if you'll be convicted even if you commit a crime. Right? Theoretically, at least, you've got to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt, and you could imagine lots of crimes, you know, they'll be able to do that. So it's true, it's not perfectly predictable whether you'll get pardoned, whether they'll offer you transportation, or whether they'll hang you. And I have some very partial figures suggesting that, in fact, not that large a fraction of the criminal defendants actually ended up getting hanged for a bunch of different reasons, although certainly some of them did. In any case, so I think those are... Now, there's another lesson, but I think I'll get to it a little bit later, which has to do with what happened when they started putting in rewards. In fact, no, I only mentioned that a little bit because I've got a little bit extra news in the book because I didn't know it at the time I wrote the book. But one problem that arose, which I mentioned somewhere in the chapter, is in the middle of the 18th century, people are unhappy about the system they think not working very well. I should say, as far as I can tell, one uniform historical fact about all societies at all times is that crime rates are increasing. I should say, as best we know, historically crime rates have decreased over time. But at any given time, people believe that they are suffering increasing crime rates because crime is bad and gets attention and you don't really have much data about the past. I don't know, do most people in America now know that crime rates have gone down a lot in the last 20 years? What? You think they do? Yeah. Well, the murder rate, I think, is maybe a third of its peak at this point. Why is not clear. I mean, there are a lot of different people have different theories, but at least that's what happened.
At least in New York, you can. Have you read the tipping point?
No, I've heard about it.
One way to combat the crime
is to get rid of minor.
Apprehended for minor crimes, as well as the subway, and it's not many individuals.
Yep. But the. So in any case, the problem that they had, I should say, so they established rewards from the crown for convictions for particular sorts of crimes, such as highway robbery. And they were large rewards. I think I worked out that if you did it in terms of wages as your measure, it was the equivalent of $100,000, at least one of them was in our system. And the problem was that you then get an incentive either to entrap people or to frame them. So that you get this Irishman fresh off the boat who doesn't know for nothing, and you say, Paddy, we could make us a lot of money by robbing that coach with all those rich people in it. Let's come along and do it. And then you arrange things so that Paddy gets caught and convicted, and you testify against him, and you collect the reward. And in some cases, they seem to have convicted people of crimes that didn't even happen by having enough false testimony. And the one thing I can add that I didn't know then is that Casanova, who is a contemporary of Boswell, who also wrote memoirs, only his are much better written because they're not a diary, they're a consciously written stuff when he was in his 60s or so. And if you want a picture of 18th century Europe, I highly recommend Casanova's memoirs. He writes well, he's an interesting guy, he knew everybody. He feuded with Voltaire, he met various kings and such and so forth. And among other things, Casanova visited London. And he mentions that during his visit in London, he noticed a particular sign, which was in a number of different, you know, windows, I guess. And it was some phrase, I don't know what the phrase was. And he asked his English friends what it meant. And they said, oh, it means perjured testimony for sale here. And you can see the potential for that kind of system any time when it is profitable to convict people of things they haven't done. All right, so let me go on to Shasta County, which is the last of the ones in the chapter, although if we have time, I may talk a little bit about some things that aren't in the chapter that I learned about later. And it's sort of a neat story because Bob Ellickson starts out with this perfectly clever project to see if Coase is right. And being a bright guy, he keeps going. He says, well, yeah, sure enough, the farmers and the ranchers behave the same way in open range and in closed range. But that's odd. Nobody's paying anybody. Coase's theory, you ought to have side payments by which if the efficient thing is for the farmer to fence out, but the law says that the rancher has to fence in, you'd expect the rancher to pay the farmer. Not happening. And so he keeps looking. And what Ellickson discovers is that, in fact, as I put it in the chapter, the law of the state of California does not run in Shasta County. I should say, Shasta County is like 2 or 3 hours from here. This is not the moon.
Yeah.
It's a rural county. And I don't know if all of this is true now, but it was true when Ellickson wrote his book. And that what's happening was set as a system of norms. And it's interesting to think about systems of norms, because when you think about them for a while, you realize that norms are a legal system, privately enforced, privately created, that all of us are a part of. That if you think about the ways in which your own behavior is constrained, my standard example is that to the best of my knowledge, if I chose to teach this class stripped to the waist, I would be violating no law. But it would be a very stupid thing to do. All right? Because it would violate norms of how respectable people behave. And you can think of a whole lot of other examples, similarly profanity, for example, that in some social circles, the norms are different. There are places where profanity is used as commas. There are other contexts, however, in which you would lose status for doing it. Incidentally, Posner's son, Eric Posner, actually has written a book on norms. And if you search far enough, you can find my review of that book. It's not all that good. It's interesting. But I think the theory he comes up with strikes me as an implausible sort of patched-up theory of how they work. But in any case, they are private legal systems. And in the case of Shasta County, they in some areas replace the formal legal system, which is basically what he discovered. And I'm not sure it's worth my running through the stuff that you've already read in the chapter. But the most interesting bit to me is where it fits into the inefficiency of efficient punishment problem. The fact that the norms constrain people to punish in ways that are unprofitable to them, in ways that are costly to them. And that makes perfectly good sense, given that this is a system where the person who is punishing is also the judge and the jury. It's a system where there's no court involved. You decide someone has wronged you and what you're going to do about it. And as long as what you're doing about it hurts you as well as him, you don't have too much incentive to do that when he hasn't really wronged you. And that's, I think, the basic logic of that system. And beyond that, Ellickson's book, which you might want to read sometime, it's called Order Without Law, talks about other systems of norms. The whaling norms are sort of interesting. And I don't think he ever gets into what ought to be a puzzle, which is why the norms are sometimes efficient and sometimes inefficient. So that my standard example of that is his whaling norms, that he describes the norms among whaling ships. These are ships at sea. There's no government around. And they have cases such as you pull in a whale, and lo and behold, it's got my marked harpoon in it. That's what weakened it, so you were able to bring it in. What happens? And there were various norms saying under what circumstances you're supposed to share the whale with me, basically, and other rules of that sort. And Ellickson is arguing that norms, at least in close-knit groups, tend to be efficient norms. And then Ellickson tells us that one of the interesting things about this story about the whales is that as time passed, one species after another was hunted into near extinction, with the result that the whalers switched to hunting some other and more difficult species of whale, and the optimal norms were different for different kinds of whales. I don't remember the details anymore, but if you look at Ellickson's book, he discusses that. And they say, wait a minute, that's very interesting. Was it efficient to hunt these whales into extinction? Isn't that a standard example of the kind of sort of externality, public good kind of problem that we expect law to deal with, is the fact that if I kill a whale today, you can't kill either it or its descendants tomorrow, and therefore we have a problem of depletion. It's a depletable resource. It's worse than a depletable resource. Oil, all that happens is if I pump a gallon, you can't pump it. But whales, whales reproduce themselves, but not after they're dead. So I don't think Ellickson, as far as I remember, discusses that. And my answer is that you get norms that are what I think, what I refer to in my review of Ellickson's book as globally efficient, as locally efficient, but not ones that are globally efficient. Where locally efficient means if you and I both practice a norm, you and I are better off. Globally efficient means if you and I practice a norm, everybody is better off, but most of that better off goes down to people. And that the former, as I discussed in the chapter, you would expect to get generated, and the latter not. Any questions of those three legal systems? Sorry. In terms of lessons for us, again, I think it does emphasize the inefficiency of efficient punishment problem, the fact that you ended up with a stable set of norms, and because the mechanisms for making sure that people who were convicted were really guilty were very, very weak, you need a mechanism to avoid making it in the interest of the innocent people, essentially, which they have. And among what strike me as the interesting issues that you get into this, one of them is what's your mechanism for enforcing the law, for prosecuting offenses, and among the observed, I think there are at least four different mechanisms I can think of, not all covered in this chapter. One of them is what we're used to, which is state actors, public police, and prosecutors. One of them is a private actor, as in the Icelandic feud, and to some extent in our tort system. The tort system, the first half of it's done privately, and then the actual enforcement is done publicly. A third mechanism, which I haven't really discussed, though I guess it comes up a little bit in the Shasta County stuff, is social pressure, ostracism. So that if you look at systems like the gypsies, for example, which I don't discuss here, but I discuss in my seminar on legal systems, one of the gypsy mechanisms essentially is you have a dispute, you take it to a meeting of all adult males who want to come, we talk for a day or two until we reach some consensus, and if you don't then go along with that consensus, no one in the society will associate, no other gypsies will associate with you. And since being a gypsy, you know that all non-gypsies are subhuman, and since you are in a society where all the non-gypsies know that all gypsies are subhuman, it's a real cost not to have your fellow gypsies associate with you. That's sort of the logic of that system. And indeed, I've argued elsewhere that what may be destroying gypsy culture in North America is that we're too tolerant. That because in the U.S. and Canada, the prejudice against gypsies is much lower than it was in Romania, say, the result is that a young adult gypsy who chooses to defy his elders has a much better option of slipping off into the general society, and that weakens the control that system has over its own members. The gypsies are one of a bunch of examples of what I refer to as embedded legal systems, in the sense that you've got an official state with a legal system, and then a group within it which enforces its own rules on its own members in some way. Gypsies have been really pretty good about that. They've got various mechanisms for staying below the radar of the official system. For example, names are not actually linked to people. The name is sort of a piece of property that we trade around as may be useful for in order to keep other people doing things that we don't want them to do. So that's a mechanism. And then the final example, which I think we've discussed before, is reputational enforcement, where the enforcement is occurring as a side effect. It isn't that somebody is trying to make the store honest, just people don't want to get cheated, and the result is that if you get a reputation for cheating people, you lose customers, and that's a reason not to cheat people. So that's a fourth mechanism if you think of ways in which legal rules actually get enforced. And the basic problem, as I've mentioned, the incentive to enforce is you need enough, but not too much. All right, let me go on to say a little bit about some other societies that I've looked at the legal system of, and I want to start with Imperial China. And Imperial China, I mentioned a little bit last time, that's a big population ruled by a small elite bureaucracy of scholar officials chosen by the original civil service exams, which were not exams in whether you were good at being a judge and whether you could write poetry and related skills. Sort of a weird system, but it worked for a long time. And the way they do it, as far as I can tell, is to subcontract ruling to other authority structures so that the legal system supports the authority of the extended family. It's a legal system where everybody is related to everybody else within the extended family as senior relative or junior relative. If you commit a crime against a junior relative, the penalty goes down. If you commit a crime against a senior relative, the penalty goes up. And if you accuse a parent of a crime, you have just committed a crime. So it's a system designed, as far as I can tell, to reinforce that authority structure. It's not the only authority structure. They've got what are sort of like merchant guilds as well, which are also supported by the state in various ways. And another part of how you do it is you make involvement with the legal system very unpleasant, so that witnesses can be flogged or tortured to make sure they tell the truth. Basically, you can be treated very badly. You can be tortured to make you confess. And the impression you get reading about it is that it is supposed to be perfectly obvious that anybody associated with the legal system who's not part of the Chinese state is a worm, and is to be treated as a worm, so to speak. People don't really have rights in our sense. And if you read the cases, at least the body of cases that I used in my class, almost all of the cases are not about who's guilty, but about what the correct punishment is. This is a legal system which, in theory, for every offense, specifies the punishment. It can never really do it, so it's got various mechanisms to fill in gaps. But that's what the arguments are mostly about. I mean, after all, how could anybody argue you were innocent? I mean, why would we have you in front of the court if you were innocent? I exaggerate, but there's at least an element of that. It's not usually... I'm not sure I can even remember any cases where it's an open question who did what, as opposed to what the legal consequences are. So one result of that is that people don't use the legal system if they can avoid it. But one further result is that if you want to get somebody in trouble, an obvious way is to accuse them of something. And the danger with that is that then you get yourself in trouble too. And the solution to that would be anonymous accusations. And the people running the Chinese state are not stupid. And so in Imperial China, for an official to read an anonymous accusation is a criminal offense by the official. And in the first round of this legal rule, at least we know about, there was an exception if the accusation was an accusation of treason against the empire. They dropped the exception. So that's sort of all of this stuff. I should say I'm not a scholar of China, so I have a tendency to see patterns. Human beings are very good at seeing patterns even when they aren't there. So don't believe with certainty everything I tell you. But as far as I can tell, that's what was going on. And one of the other features of that legal system was that you, as far as I can tell, don't have what we would recognize as civil law. So that if I lend you money and you don't pay it back, there does not appear to be any mechanism for suing you. What can I do? I can go to the district magistrate and report you as a swindler. What does the magistrate do? He can say, sorry, buddy, I'm busy. He can go to you and say, you're a swindler. I'm going to prove you're a swindler, and I'm going to have you flogged for being a swindler. He could go to you and say, pay him half the money you owe him, and we'll forget about it. Or he could insist on you paying all the money. It's entirely up to him. It's a criminal case, not a civil case. What's interesting is that despite this, they have very elaborate contractual practice without essentially any contract law. That it turns out that around 1900, China cedes the island of Taiwan to Japan. I think they'd lost a war. I don't remember the details. And the Japanese decide that instead of trying to impose Japanese law on a population that doesn't speak Japanese and has different customs, they will simply enforce existing Chinese law. And the only problem is that to enforce Chinese law, you have to find out what it is. And so there's an elaborate scholarly research project producing like 20 volumes, I gather, a lot of documents, simply researching Chinese law on Taiwan at the time. And some modern, I think, American scholars have mined this source of information for quite an interesting chapter on Chinese contractual practice. And they say you have roughly a modern, sophisticated system of contractual practice, and then an interesting question of how you make it work. And I've got, I think, did I have you read my China to Cyberspace article or the other course?
Yes.
I did, anyway. So that's, you know about that there. But that's another thing. I mentioned briefly the Cheyenne Indians, and one of the intriguing features there was the idea that there was essentially a magical punishment for killing another Cheyenne, which nobody can cancel. Consequently, you could have a society where casual violence is quite common, but where lethal violence is uncommon. The last one that I think I want to discuss is Jewish law, which was the newest of the ones that I started investigating because I got bored with stuff I'd done several times. And that has a whole bunch of interesting problems. And one of them is what I think of as the fixed point problem. And the problem is you have a legal system which is ultimately based on some divinely authoritative source of law. And this isn't only the case of Jewish law. It's true of Islamic law. It's true of American constitutional law. We don't literally say the Constitution was written by God, but we treat it as if it was. Well, this raises a couple of problems. One of the problems is, what if God got it wrong? What if there are legal rules in the Torah which no reasonable person wants to impose? Or if they just didn't cover some of the things that have arisen since that was written? So one of the classic examples is that according to the Torah, if a son is disobedient to his parents and gives them lip, his mother and father are supposed to take him to the communal authorities to have him stoned to death. And it is, I do not think I have come across any Jewish legal authority of the past 2,500 years who thought that was a good idea. And the problem is, how do you get out of doing it? And there are a lot of other problems. Under the Jewish law, according to the Torah is the first five books of the Old Testament. And under Jewish law, according to the Torah, every seventh year all deaths are canceled. And God wasn't stupid. God saw the implications of this, and God said, and on the sixth year, don't be selfish and refuse to lend to your neighbor in need just because you'll never pay the money back. Be generous and lend to him anyway. So the problem was seen, but it's obviously a very serious problem, and so the rabbis came up with a legal formula called prosbul, which was basically a way of getting the court to sort of sign a loan to say this loan goes through the 7 years and can be collected thereafter. So that would be another case. And there are a number of mechanisms, I guess a couple of, at least two major mechanisms for working around this system. And one of them is a wonderful invention called the Oral Torah. The written Torah is the first five books of the Old Testament. The Oral Torah is the stuff that God told Moses that didn't get written down, and that Moses then transmitted to other people, and through a chain of oral transmissions, it came to the legal authorities, to the legal scholars of 200 or 300 BC, and therefore, when they explained that what the Torah really meant didn't fit very carefully with what the Torah said, that was because Moses had told so-and-so, who told so-and-so, who told them. So that was sort of a device for getting around it. One part of that particular device is that there is a passage in Torah which says essentially, if it isn't clear what the law is or what the implications of the law is, go to the legal scholars and abide by the view of the majority. And this gets interpreted to be that majority vote of the legal scholars can decide the law, even if there isn't in fact anything in Torah that's relevant to the existing law. And this is also relevant to another problem that comes out of the same issue. And that problem is that truth is not made by majority vote. So if you are a Jewish legal scholar and thus probably also a judge, or very likely also a judge, and you believe reading Torah that it clearly says X, you will naturally want to decide cases according to X. But that legal scholar over there reading Torah interprets it differently, and he decides Y, and you now have a legal system where what the law is depends on which judge you go to. That's not very satisfactory. And the solution that they came up with is truth is not decided by majority vote, but law is. So that the basic doctrine was that if a legal scholar disagreed with the majority, and by the time this is really working, you have a formal body called the Sanhedrin of legal scholars so you can actually take votes. If a legal scholar disagrees with the majority, he can continue forever to argue for his position, but he may not judge according to his position. He's got to judge according to the majority view. Have I discussed the furnace of Achnai here?
The what?
furnace of Octani.
Yes.
I did. All right. Because that's the story which really deals with just that. It's, again, I find it hard to keep track of what I have or haven't done. So pretty clearly the part of the bottom line of that story is God no longer gets to decide with the lawyers. God's given us that job, and we may get it wrong, but what we get is what the lawyers. And that's just what they did. The other interesting bit of that, and another interesting bit of that whole system, which you see in a number of other systems, is it might occur to you to wonder, what does Jewish law have to do with anything in the world once the kingdom of Israel is no longer a going concern? That the kingdom of Israel is, for various periods of time, an independent state. It is then a state under Roman de facto rule. Eventually, there are a couple of very bloody revolts put down quite effectively by the Romans, who could have given Gaddafi lessons in this subject, alas. And at that point, you have the diaspora, and the Jewish population is largely scattered around the Mediterranean world, and you no longer really have a functioning kingdom of Israel. And you might say, well, that's it. That's the end of Jewish law. But it isn't the end of Jewish law. Jewish law continues. The real end of Jewish law is in the late 18th century, with the emancipation is the term that's used. And the emancipation is the shift of European governments from regarding the Jews and their territories, Jews who happen to live in France, to regarding them as Frenchmen who happen to be Jews. And that prior to that, the normal arrangement in both the Christian and Muslim world was that Jewish communities were self-ruling, essentially, again, subcontracted to the ruler. That the ruler said, all right, here are the taxes you owe us. You, communal authorities of the Jewish community here, make sure we get paid our taxes, make sure your people don't give us any trouble, and it's up to you there beyond that. And that's the system under which you had functioning Jewish law for most of 2,000 years. And that was an interesting system, in part because it's a decentralized system. There is no Supreme Court. And in the early centuries, the Babylonian academies were considered the sort of most authoritative source of information. They are where I think the Talmud was produced, if I remember correctly. After a while, for some reason, they lose their authority, and you end up with a situation where, basically, insofar as they're authorities, they are people like Maimonides, who simply have the reputation of being very learned and scholarly sorts, and that's about all. And yet, it maintains itself as a functioning legal system for a long period of time. Did I discuss the question of marriage laws? I may have discussed that one, too. It's something I may use as filler when I run out of stuff to talk about. Marriage law and Jewish law. You've got the following.
Yeah,
I did. The basic issue is that theoretically you're supposed to have legal scholars tell you what the law is. But in the diaspora, there are often communities who don't have legal scholars. And you have communal authorities who would like to function, as it were, as governments. And it's decided you can do that with regard to material matters, but not religious matters. And then you have the problem of their attempt to control marriage rules, which is basically a religious matter, and various workarounds by which they try to do that, which I think I discussed last time, so I won't do this time. All right, so we can go on to the crime-tort problem next time. I hope that you will not only read the chapter, but think about what, to me at least, is one of the most interesting questions that legal people never think about, which is why we have a redundant legal system, why we've got both crime law and tort law doing more or less the same work in different ways.